Welcome back to Season 2 of Sit Still Look Opinionated, the podcast. I'm your host, Claire Malky. So, did you all have an excellent Labor Day weekend? Did you celebrate a national holiday of rest in order to honor workers? What a concept. Or, if you work in the service industry, the day otherwise known as, wow, it's really busy for a Monday. Oh wait, it's a holiday? Makes sense. Hold on, I'm getting paid holiday pay, right? Hells yeah. I'd say it's ironic, but that's the gig economy, baby. Speaking of national holidays, today, September 11th, 2020, marks 19 years since the tragic attacks on the Twin Towers, the Pentagon, and the crash of Flight 93. We want to honor all the lives that were lost in this horrific event. We'd like to honor them now with a moment of silence. Thanks for that. We have a great episode in store for you all today. We're starting off strong with this week's top headlines. Then, for the deep dive, we discuss a topic that honestly used to frighten me. But don't worry, education helped me tackle that fear. And we'll round out the show with my interview with licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. And you know we can't start the show without a delicious margarita. So go grab your tequila and lime and let's get started. First, this week's headlines. Last weekend, several boats sank during a boat parade in honor of President Trump. Trump supporters are organizing another parade this weekend because, quote, boat lives matter. All in all, the parade was a perfect analogy for voter support of Trump using the Dido strategy, as they are prepared to go down with this ship. Critics have taken it a step further by saying it's not the Dido strategy, but the Drake remix strategy, describing the incident as, started from the bottom, now we're even further at the bottom. Onlookers of the event say that the capsizing of these boats was caused by tough winds, high wakes from other boats, and Nancy Pelosi's haircut. After criticism of his COVID-19 response, Trump stated, I'm a cheerleader for this country. I can see it now. Trump in a crop top, short skirts, and pom-poms shouting, 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? Definitely not the average American citizen. Go Trump! Which, like, I'm pretty sure Trump is not the cheerleader I would ever have in mind. For real, Trump in a cheerleader outfit? Nope. That picture of him playing tennis is already too disturbing. Having Trump's words recorded on tape made it easy to rebuke Press Secretary McEnany's claim that these were alleged comments. Basically, Republican talking points on this matter don't seem to hold any water. But their boats sure do. Wildfires in California have become so extreme, plumes of smoke have blocked out the sun, causing a gloomy doomsday glow around whole cities. Never have vampires been so excited to not have to use Instagram filters. Citizens across the United States have offered any support they can to help California with its fires. In fact, over last weekend, several citizens in Texas anticipated the wildfires and tried to stock up on hundreds of gallons of water by loading it onto their boats. Yes, I am aware that we are really going all in on these boat jokes, but my favorite hobby at the moment is beating a dead horse. Speaking of which, on Tuesday, Georgia's state secretary said that as many as 1,000 cases of double voting have been detected. This might be due to events that happened last week when Trump encouraged his supporters in North Carolina to commit voter fraud. In breaking news, VP nominee Kamala Harris was spotted wearing Chuck Taylors during a campaign trip to Milwaukee. With multiple stories from major news networks about a woman's shoe choice, it seems like these outlets are really trying to lace this story together. This week, the Chicago City Council banned the sale of flavored vaping tobacco products like chocolate, which are meant to entice children. But seriously, who would want to buy chocolate Juul pods? Tobacco and chocolate? No thank you. If Juul was a smart company, they would create flavors to market to the millennial crowd. Flavors like a livable minimum wage, student loan forgiveness, and Bernie Sanders. And that's this week's headlines. Up next, this week's deep dive. In previous episodes, we discussed aspects of society that tend to, as a whole, be considered dangerous. Things like fascism and the spread of misinformation. But if you were to expand your view of either subject, it'd be clear that both are ideological concepts that attack critical thinking. I bring this up because not only does demonizing critical thinking go against the core values of this podcast, but also lays at the heart of today's topic, cults. We've all heard of cults, and I'm sure that we all like to think that we know what cults are. Of course, my journey in making this podcast has led me to the realization that cults are not a football team based in Indianapolis, and that I know nothing and must constantly grovel to Google for more information like some modern-day mentally starved version of Oliver Twist. So I'm going to spoon-feed it to you guys the same way Alexa spoon-fed it to me. Let's start by asking, what is a cult? By definition, a cult is a system of religious veneration and devotion directed toward a particular figure or object, which makes sense. I feel like a lot of people think about cults in a purely religious sense. Things like Scientology and Scientology. However, when I think of modern cults, political groups, expensive fitness regimens, or maybe fraternities tend to come to mind. But what do cults actually stand for, and how are they different from an obsessive fan community? And what are the characteristics that make it? Now, there is a lot of gray area when it comes to the hard and fast rules about cults. And they can be tough to identify from the inside out. What's that saying? If someone says you're in a cult and you say, I'm not in a cult, then you might be in a cult. Well, yes and no. Here are some of the hallmarks of major cults throughout the ages. And don't worry, you can trust me. I'm not in a cult. For starters, cults tend to be centered around a charismatic leader. Even though you might not be able to name a cult leader off the top of your head, I can guess you've all seen this trope. Some guy stands with confidence on a stage and proclaims, I'll solve all your problems if you follow my way. Pretty easy to conjure up. The thing is, cults might not always start off this way. While charismatic leaders are a defining characteristic of cults, these groups tend to initially start off as a community of core values, with emphasis of the group identity over individual identity. But over time, these charismatic leaders emerge and increasingly become praised or even worshipped by the existing community. And these strong values get washed away as group members more and more look to the charismatic leader for answers and guidance. All that to say, it then becomes less about the group identity and more so about the leader's perception of what should be the group identity. So far, cults are categorized by having a charismatic leader and a groupthink mentality. Okay, but that basically describes every Facebook group and high school extracurricular activity that I've ever experienced. How is that dangerous? Well, along with the charismatic leader, cults tend to exhibit a process of intense or even coercive brainwashing. Although according to my research, that term brainwashing isn't super PC among the psychology community. The more academic terms tend to refer to the phrases thought reform or ideological totalism. But let's be real, I'm still going to call it brainwashing. Nice try, you liberal elites, but I've seen enough James Bond movies to know that all you have to do is not look at a swirly black and white circle for too long. Check and mate. Dr. Robert J. Lifton actually breaks down the specific forms of thought control and how to identify them in his book, Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism, which is less like an actual book and more like an essay on psychological study that is just so long the publisher was like, fuck it, let's just call it a book. Like, that junk is dense. But getting back to it, the brainwashing is the beginning stages of a cult's attack on critical thinking. And the process is subtle. The consistent emphasis of group over individual becomes such an overwhelming social pressure that it manifests itself into a mold of thought reform that causes people to take actions that aren't in their own best interests. Hence, the brainwashing. And those not in your best interest activities can be anywhere from draining your bank account to sexual abuse. Any sort of exploitation sadly fits this bill. In a nutshell, if a group exhibits these behaviors, then they're definitely a cult. But here's the catch. Not every cult exactly fits the same mold. And not every group that engages with one or two of these qualities is a cult. That's what makes them such a particularly intriguing subject. And with over 1,000 cults in America alone, the nuances can be difficult to see at the surface. Ultimately, the number one defining factor of a cult is that they abuse and harm their members. Again, the most common elements of abuse are usually financial or sexual in nature. So if all of these things are true, why do smart people like our family and friends sometimes fall for cults? Well, the thing is, cults offer, or appear to offer, answers to this world's most challenging questions. Things like, where am I going in life? Why do I feel so alone? Will I ever find a purpose? You know, all the hard-hitting, life-altering, existential questions. And if they have the answers, then that takes away the exhausting task of having to look for them. It's one of the reasons that so many cults are based in religion. It gives you certainty. I'm certain that when I die, I'll go to heaven. I'm certain that there is a higher being that watches over and protects me. I'm certain that telling you my darkest secrets while holding these soup cans will clear me of my sins. Now you may be thinking, sure, having the answer sounds great, but some of these answers sound pretty ridiculous. There's no way that someone smart would hear that and agree with it. Well, there are two main other factors that play into it: loneliness and trauma. A good majority of people who end up joining cults join at a peak moment of transition in their lives, and not the cute Pinterest bloom where you're planted kind. It's either a life-upending move like losing a job or the death of a loved one, or if they have suffered from some extreme trauma in the past. These types of changes can affect a person's psychological state, which allows them to be more open to accepting these things that sound enticing as true, especially if what is being offered is a direct solution to their problems. When you combine that vulnerability with the prospect of community, it's only amplified. With trauma and change often come pangs of loneliness. I mean, did anyone else live through quarantine, or was that just me? And we as human beings crave social interaction and support. All of a sudden, here comes a group of people who tell you that they accept you, that they love you, and that they have solutions to your problems. When you feel accepted, when you feel supported, when you feel like you know the answers, that is how people join cults. Once they get a foot in the door, then it's a slippery slope, my friends. Although cults are fascinating and pose questions about human behavior, you might be wondering why we, a political and comedy podcast, focused an entire episode around them. Well, it all circles back to critical thinking. Remember that notion from before? Critical thinking is a powerful tool, and it's sometimes considered to be an enemy of those in power. If the masses start questioning the authority, it could spell disaster for the few wielding the control. The ability to analyze a situation and question its validity is crucial to maintaining individuality. And that idea of individuality is pivotal in separating a committed group from something dangerous. To quote Caspar Turkile in his book, The Power of Ritual, it is important to know that a strong community should not deny one's own individuality. That's when communities become cults. A community can only flourish when each individual member flourishes. Nobody is forced to surrender their identity or level of skill and confidence. In this age of the internet and instant media, sometimes the individual just gets lost in the hashtag trends. In terms of politics, two groups that seem to have most aptly fit this description come to mind: MAGA hat people and Bernie bros. Before we get ahead of ourselves, I know what you're thinking. Wait, Claire, I thought this was a liberal-leaning podcast. Are you bashing Bernie Sanders? Not entirely. Mostly just his followers. You know, the cultish kind. We're not tearing down Sanders' overarching goals, i.e. Medicare for All or the Green New Deal. We are merely pointing out how some of Bernie's diehard fans exhibit dangerous, cult-like behaviors, the same way liberals talk about Trump supporters. We're essentially addressing the Spider-Man pointing to Spider-Man meme. To be clear, we are not saying that MAGA people nor Bernie bros are full-out cults. We're not saying that, got it? We are not saying they are cults. We're just saying they might be. Capiche? Great. Now, with the MAGA crowd, for me, it's pretty easy to see the connection between Trump's base and the cult identifiers. MAGA members circle around their quote-unquote charismatic leader. This leader is always right. He ignores facts. He disavows and discredits major institutions, voting by mail and moving the election, and there is absolutely zero room to question his authority. And those who do critique his actions get the boot, with Trump proclaiming, fake news, or the enemy, or a hoax. It's basically his way of telling Twitter, you're fired. Which honestly would be more presidential than the junk he says on a daily basis. Now, the thing about Trump and MAGA minds that separates him from Sanders and Bernie bros is that Trump actively encourages his base to separate themselves from rational thinking. Like how any critical press he receives is fake news or harassment. He's literally called the press the enemy of the people. His Twitter alone is disturbing enough. And the crazy thing about Trump is that people adore him. Dare I say, worship him. A quick Google search will bring up numerous videos of his supporters taking his word at face value, hear him contradict himself, and then defend his new opposing stance, all in the matter of 5 minutes. Research from the University of Cambridge even shows that Trump's voters tend to harbor racist and anti-immigrant sentiments. And according to Loyola University of Chicago and University of Alabama researchers Ruchin and Edwards, there's even been an uptick of hate crimes in the counties that voted for Trump in 2016. Ruchin and Edwards even suggest that Trump's presidency gave aggressors the validation and empowerment they needed to commit heinous crimes. Brace yourself for this next part. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably already lean fairly liberal yourself and don't need much to buy into the Trump's yo MAGA MAGA followers being a cult. It's easy to think that when you have the opportunity to look down on the opposing side. Me included. But what about when you point the camera at yourself? When it comes to Bernie bros, I'm here to point out that some of their collective actions encapsulate some cult-like behaviors. You may be asking yourself, what is a Bernie bro? It occurred to me that some people in my family are unfamiliar with this term and simply refer to them as commie bastards. Well, no, that's not what a Bernie bro is. Think of it this way. If MAGA fans are known for being racist and prejudiced against women, Bernie bros are just prejudiced against women. But they cite their sources for it. How academic. Point one, charismatic leader. When I think about it, Bernie falls into the same bucket of charismatic as Trump, which is old man screams at bird level of charisma. That type of YouTube charisma that is so appealing to Facebook feed algorithms. Look, in this day and age, if it's enough to get your attention on TikTok, it's basically a fully funded presidential campaign. And point two, the leader can do no wrong. The prime example that jumps to mind is the comment Bernie allegedly said about a woman can't be president. Not only did Bernie bros defend him adamantly, but they also openly attacked those who criticized Bernie for his alleged comments. According to Vox, after Senator Warren stood up for herself in regards to Sanders' comment, her social media was inundated with snake emojis and other abusive messages, like she was a traitor to the left for questioning her colleague. We bring up MAGA and Bernie bros today to examine how, even though a group might not 100% be a cult, the group could still be detrimental to the well-being of its members or the greater population. Again, not every single Trump or Sanders supporter fits this description. But on the spectrum of extremes, with MAGAites and Bernie bros, they tend to fall under this umbrella. Both groups deny any questioning of their leaders and are quick to villainize anyone who opposes them. And we're not just talking about little jabs here and there. We're talking about dangerous harassment and abuse. We are also not saying that only megalomaniacs and Bernie boobs fall into the category of cult-like behavior, just that they are two examples that we can easily use to demonstrate our thesis, that critical thinking is vital to the survival of this country. As of now, there are over 3,000 cults in America, and they range from strictly religious to political to much more subtle forms. And we want to do our best to let you know what to look for in the case that you find yourself questioning, am I in a cult? With that said, here are a list of warning signs for a potentially unsafe group or leader that The Guardian posted a while back. We'll also provide the list in the show notes. Absolute authoritarianism without meaningful accountability. No tolerance for questions or critical inquiry. No meaningful financial disclosure regarding budgets or expenses, such as independently audited financial statements. Unreasonable fear about the outside world, such as impending catastrophe, evil conspiracies, QAnon, and persecutions. There is no legitimate reason to leave. Former followers are always wrong in leaving, negative, or even evil. There are records, books, news articles, or broadcast reports that document the abuse of the group/leader. Followers feel like they can never be good enough. The group/leader is always right, And the group slash leader is the exclusive means of knowing truth or receiving validation. No other process of discovery is really acceptable or credible. All this to say, don't take our politicians' words as scripture. They're just people like you and me. But somehow in this system, we have deemed them capable of making decisions on all of our behalfs. And I want to put my faith in something greater than myself, but not at the cost of my own life. Now, stay safe and enjoy our interview with licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. So for today's interview, we have Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. She is a licensed clinical psychologist, and we are so happy to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
I am good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. So today we're talking about cults, which is a subject you are very well versed in. And I just kind of wanted to ask you, what's your background? How did you sort of find your way into this subject?
Sure. So I have a doctorate in psychology, and my doctoral dissertation was on the topic of doing therapy with former cult members. But I have had an interest in cults for long before then. Boy, going over 20 years at this point, I guess. So the story goes that I'm not a former cult member. That is not what drew me to this work. I know that's the case for some people, but it's not the case for me. So my father worked in the film industry for his whole career. And he worked on the Tom Cruise movie Days of Thunder. And I was about 10 years old at the time. And I was a precocious kid. And I remember they shot a lot of that movie on location in Florida. And my mother and I went out there to stay with my dad for a while. And I remember all of the grown-ups talking about Scientology. Oh, Tom Cruise, Scientologist. And being a curious kid, I was like, what's that? And no one could answer my question. I don't remember if anybody used the word cult at the time, but I just thought it was very weird that all these people knew about this thing that was maybe a religion, but couldn't really tell me anything about it. Because, you know, I was raised in LA. It's not that hard. You know, if somebody's Christian, they can tell you what they believe. If somebody's Jewish, they could tell you what they believe. But nobody could tell me what Scientology was about. So I thought, that's strange. And so, fast forward to when I was in high school and the internet became a thing, I started to do some research on Scientology. And that led me to the growing community of former Scientologists on the internet who were saying some very interesting things about this organization. And that just led me to, want to learn more, not just about Scientology, but about cults in general. And it just kind of became like a hobby. It was something I liked to read about or watch things about or whatever. And by the time I got into the field of psychology and it was time to write a dissertation, I just narrowed it down to that topic because I just felt like these are, it's a small but underserved population of people who really need some help from what they have most likely been through. And so ever since I have been doing my best to work with former cult members and try to help them heal from their experiences.
Yeah, that's really an amazing story. And we in the episode touch a little bit on Scientology. So joke at it, for lack of a better term. But you touched on, I'm a Christian, I can tell you what that is. I'm a Jew, I can tell you what that is. What is sort of that difference between cult and religion?
Sure. So something that's important to keep in mind is that oftentimes when we talk about cults, people are talking about religious or spiritual cults. The reality is that a cult can be based around any sort of philosophy. It does not have to be spiritual or religious. Plenty of them are, but there are political cults. There are financial cults. A lot of people would consider multi-level marketing companies to be very cult-like. There are self-help and psychology, related cults. So to me, what differentiates a cult from a religion is that, and this could open a larger philosophical discussion that we probably shouldn't be getting into. This isn't the right forum for it. But by and large, cults, whatever philosophy or leader they are based on, are exploitative and abusive to their members. Religions generally are not. And again, people would argue with that, I'm sure. But in my experience, both personally and professionally, you know, cults actively do harm to people, usually under deceptive measures, that you don't see that kind of active harm being done to people in mainstream, you know, worldwide religious groups.
Mm-hmm. So it's more of something that is exploiting the members and people who
exactly.
are part of
yeah.
it.
Yeah, regardless of what they believe or what they practice, there is an element of exploitation and abuse.
Mm-hmm. And in my research that I've been doing for this episode, I found that sometimes that's really hard to see when it mm-hmm. when a cult is presented. Could you kind of speak on more of that? Like, why these things seem so enticing? Why a smart person would somehow be led to join a cult?
Sure. I mean, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that people like answers.
Mm-hmm.
People like certainty. It's something that as humans we are drawn to. And most cults or high demand groups or abusive groups, whatever word you want to use for it, present, whether it's true or not, present a worldview or a belief system that seems very certain of itself. You know, like, do X, Y, and Z, and you will be saved, or you will understand yourself, or you will be a millionaire, or whatever it is. And people are drawn to that. You know, we like answers. We like the feeling of it's secure, right? It gives us a feeling of security to have these answers. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, very intelligent people can be drawn into cult-like groups, and it can be that certainty factor. It can also be that, you know, these groups are oftentimes very manipulative and skilled at recruiting members. And, you know, I think that the internet and social media have made life a lot harder for cults, because it's harder for them to keep a lid on critical information, or oftentimes factual information about these groups. But honestly, you know, if somebody knows somebody who's in a group and they kind of get recruited and they're encouraged to not listen to criticism or look into this group beyond what they have to offer, it's not that hard for people to get sucked into that. And this isn't quite the question you asked, but it's related,
yeah.
Which is that people are most often vulnerable to getting involved in a cult during periods of life transition, mm-hmm. right? Going away to college, divorce, lost your job, etc. And again, it's about that sense of certainty, like kind of being adrift in the world and then feeling like, oh, now I have a direction, right? And your intelligence makes no difference with that. You know, everybody goes through these transitions, and if you're at the wrong place at the wrong time, you might end up getting sucked into a group like that.
Yeah. That totally makes sense, because in those moments of change, like, you want something to help you and like mm-hmm. give you solace.
Very much so.
So in today's world of COVID and the political climate, do you think like cults are on the rise? Do you think they, with the internet, it's not so much happening? What's your kind of take on that?
I would say, and this is not, there's not a ton of like rigorous scientific research done on cults, because, well, lots of reasons, but it's difficult. So this is not based on like necessarily research numbers. This is my kind of anecdotal observations, is that I don't really know that cults are on the rise. I think they're probably right around where they usually are. But I think that public interest in them waxes and wanes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going through a period of time where people are very interested in them. I don't know if it's partially the true crime renaissance or whatever, but, you know, I think it's not just that cults are out there more, it's that people are kind of paying attention to them more. That being said, I'm sure you could make an argument that, much like for individuals, periods of transition can make one vulnerable to a group like that, times of civil I don't know what, I don't even know what word I want to use. Civil uncertainty, crazy news every day, you know, a lot of tension, at least in our country.
Yeah.
That might make cults a little more popular. You know, people, again, looking for that certainty or answers, given how between COVID and politics and civil rights and everything, things just seem very chaotic. That's certainly possible.
Yeah. You had mentioned earlier that there can be political cults, and this podcast is all about, you know, thinking for yourself and having tough conversations and doing deeper research. Do you, in your opinion, see any of today's political figures in America, I'm mostly referring to, like, showing cult-like tendencies? And also, if not, if that's sort of just something that the internet has created.
Sure. You know, I certainly think that, you know, when I talk about, when I mention political cults, mm-hmm. I am thinking more of fringe groups.
Okay.
However, I think that a lot of cult scholars would say that most cult leaders are, for lack of a, and this is not a diagnosis, but for lack of a better way of saying it, malignant narcissists. And there are a lot of people that would call the current president of the United States a malignant narcissist. And there are certainly parallels between a lot of his behaviors and cult leader behaviors. However, I certainly wouldn't call him a cult leader. I wouldn't call the Republican Party a cult. It just doesn't meet the criteria. Mm-hmm. But there are some troubling elements of cult-like groupthink and cult-like dynamics amongst some of the kind of more, even for the mainstream, kind of more fringe elements of the mainstream, if that makes sense.
Yeah, groupthink, that is, mm-hmm. that's a big part of it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned malignant narcissist. Can you kind of talk about more what that means and what that phrase is?
Sure. So just so people know, that's not a formal diagnosis. Narcissist isn't a formal diagnosis. There is something called narcissistic personality disorder. That is a diagnosis. And this is not an area of specialty for me, so mm-hmm. I'm not going to speak on it like I have a ton of authority. But essentially, it is a person who consistently overvalues their own actions, their own intelligence, their own motives and intentions, people who really think they can do no wrong ever, people who can never apologize, people who can never learn from their mistakes because they don't ever think they make them.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that leads to pretty unhealthy behavior in their personal relationships. Because how can you have a relationship with someone who's never wrong and, you know, always thinks that their needs come before everyone else's?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of a general overview of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And not being able to admit your faults or see where, you know, there's a need for change. That's mm-hmm. not a great quality. That's something that,
no.
Yeah, not at all.
Not at all. Yeah. The inability to take in new information and then go, oh, I need to maybe revise some of my beliefs based on this new information. Not being able to do that, that's not great.
Yeah.
In any level, politics or anywhere else, that's not great.
In any form of life.
Mm-hmm.
We're mostly focused on American politics and American culture. Mm-hmm. And from what I've done some research on, there seem to be a lot of cults in America. Are cults like part of our fabric, or do they happen across the world? Sort of what's the world landscape like?
They definitely happen across the world. Mm-hmm. They can take various forms and again be spiritual or religious or not at all. But they definitely can occur. I'm trying to think right now if I know of a country or a continent that I don't know of a cult, past or present, on, and I really can't think of any. Mm-hmm. Maybe Antarctica. I don't know, but I don't know that that's fair.
Yeah, there's no people.
yeah. but I mean, there certainly are a lot in America, and they do seem to cluster in urban areas. I'm in LA, and we certainly have our share of questionable groups all the way to cults. So, I mean, I don't know, maybe we pay attention more to the ones that are in America. Mm-hmm. But there have been, like, there was the Order of the Solar Temple in Switzerland, and, you know, there's been, there was Colonia Dignidad in South America. So there's definitely been, there's plenty of cults in other countries too.
Yeah. That's kind of good to know, because I was learning about all these different groups, and I was like, oh my gosh, like, is this just something that is happening here? And that's good to know that, you know, this happens across the whole world and the human experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, just to give you an idea, the group that I refer to the most when people want to learn about cults or former cult members need help is the International Cultic Studies Association. And they have an annual conference. Obviously, it's virtual right now.
Yeah.
It alternates. One year it's in America somewhere, and then one year it's abroad somewhere. So clearly there's enough, you know, cult activity abroad to support, you know, an international conference on it in another country every other year. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So when it comes to what a cult is and why people join them, about what makes up a cult, like what are the main elements of them?
Sure. So like I said before, my very general definition of a cult is a group that is exploitive and or abusive of its members. Obviously, that's kind of general. So in the field of cultic studies, we don't really have one, and maybe we should, but I don't even know how you'd make that happen. But we don't really have one like agreed upon set of criteria. Like if a group meets 7 of these 10 criteria, it's a cult. We don't really have that. What we do have, and what I generally refer to, is we have 2 sets of criteria by 2 people who are no longer with us, but were very big scholars in this field of study. One is the criteria outlined by Dr. Margaret Singer, who wrote an amazing book, Cults in Our Midst. That is, I would recommend that to anybody. That was kind of the first book I ever read about cults. And then also Dr. Robert Lifton. Dr. Singer's list is 6, and I believe Lifton's is 8. So they, if you Google those, they are both great ways to look at it. And I'll just kind of run down Singer's criteria really quickly. And before I do, a question people often ask me is like, well, okay, we've got these sets of criteria here. How many of them does a group need to meet to be a cult, right? Again, there's no clear cut answer. And I would say that oftentimes, and you'll see this, you'll see it more with Lifton's list, but most groups of people will meet like maybe 1 or 2 of these criteria, right? That doesn't make them a cult. In my opinion and expertise, what makes a group a cult is if it meets most or all of these criteria, then you've got a problem on your hands. So just to give you Dr. Singer's list real quick, the first one is to keep the person unaware of what's going on and how they are being changed one step at a time. If a group does that, problematic. 2, these groups typically control a person's social and or physical environment, and they especially control the person's time. Oftentimes when somebody joins a group like this, they will either slowly or quickly disappear from your life because they're just constantly doing things with the group. 3, these groups systematically create a sense of powerlessness in the person, the idea that you cannot and should not live life outside of this group and you won't survive if you don't. 4, these groups often manipulate a system of rewards, punishments, and experiences in such a way as to inhibit behavior that reflects the person's former social identity. So that's a fancy way of saying that experiences are manipulated in such a way that you're discouraged from being your kind of old self and you're encouraged to take on the mantle of this new self. A lot of people associate this in groups with like being given a new name, right? They also can, this is number five, they manipulate a system of rewards and punishments in order to promote learning the group's ideology and group approved behavior. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is that these groups often put forth a closed system of logic and an authoritarian structure that permits no feedback, and cannot be modified except by leadership approval or executive order. So if there's a group and it meets most or all of those six criteria, it's probably a cult.
Yeah. While you were reading that list, I kind of was thinking back to my Greek life days, and it makes me kind of wonder. I mean, I loved my time there, but, you know, obviously being an individual, I think, is the thing that
It
sets it apart. And I'm very much still my own person.
Yes. I've definitely had people ask me before, what about the Greek system? Is that cults? And I will put it out there. I was not a part of the Greek system when I was in college. And I didn't really have any friends that were, so I don't have intimate. I know what I've seen on TV, which I don't know if that's very accurate or not. But again, I don't think that the Greek system itself is inherently problematic. Like, I think there are probably some fraternities and sororities that take it too far, but I would imagine they're a minority. And again, like I said, most groups of people will meet like one or two of these criteria, whether it's singers or lift-ins. Mm-hmm. It's just how groups of people tend to behave. It's when they meet most or all of them that it's like, okay, we got a problem here.
Yeah. So it's more the, like, it's not like one thing, but if all of it encapsulated, that makes it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Because being somebody that has worked in the field of addiction, and I've worked in treatment centers for many years before I went into private practice, you know, I would frequently run into people who would say, well, you know, it is a cult, man. And, you know, I would say, well, you picked the wrong person to say that in front of, because I know a lot about AA and I know a lot about cults. And the short answer is 12-step programs are not cults. But people would often pick up that criteria of systematically creating a sense of powerlessness in the person, because the first step of any 12-step program is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, food, whatever, mm-hmm. and our lives had become unmanageable. Okay, yes, the same word is used, powerlessness. But AA never tries to tell you that you cannot survive without AA, right? Mm-hmm. Individuals in AA may tell you that. They are not speaking for the organization as a whole. That is their personal opinion, and it might be wrong, right? Where the issue is, and AA, it's about being powerless over alcohol, mm-hmm. specifically alcohol, because you're an alcoholic, right? Where it becomes a problem in a group is where it's like, not only are you powerless, period, as a person, you are so powerless and defective that you cannot survive without this group or its ideology, mm-hmm. right? That's a pretty big difference.
Yeah, that's a very large difference for sure.
Yeah.
And something that I want to know is, like, why is it important to understand what a cult is? Why should our listeners, like, really understand the ins and outs of what a cult is?
Sure. So the longer I work, you know, because in my private practice, mm-hmm. My two big specialties are addiction and trauma. This is not a huge cult. The cult issue is not as big of an issue if we're just talking sheer numbers of people who are struggling with something. Mm-hmm. Not nearly where the number of people that struggle with addiction or trauma, right? So this is not a huge group of people that we're talking about here that are affected by this. However, the longer I work in all of these areas, the more parallels I see between cults and unhealthy and abusive relationships, mm-hmm. between cults and highly dysfunctional and abusive families, right? So when somebody asks me a question like that, I think that it's important for people to be aware of cults. For the same reason, I think it's important for people to be aware of, like, red flags of unhealthy relationships and abusive relationships, you know, common issues in dysfunctional and abusive families, because it helps people identify when they might be in a really problematic or abusive situation. Mm-hmm. Or it will give people red flags to look out for where, you know, as they're entering into a relationship, if they start to see certain things, they might be like, ooh, I don't know if I should be involved with this person. Same thing with a group. if you start to be involved in a group and you start to see these things, it's like, oh, hang on a second. Maybe I should rethink my my involvement with this particular group. So that's why I think it's important is to either, it either helps people who are already in it, or it might actually prevent people from getting involved in certain groups past a particular point.
Yeah. That seems really important to just, you know, through school and everything, we did a lot of like sensitivity trainings to know when, like, if your sorority sister is going out with a guy, those sorts of things. And I feel like maybe it's sort of the same thing with these groups, that you can apply that to a larger group, that it can still be. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, excellent point. That I hadn't thought of that, but that applies as well. Red flags to look for in a loved one, right? Mm-hmm. Like, same thing. Like, oh, is my friend in an abusive relationship, or is my friend possibly getting sucked into a cult, mm-hmm. right? Things that you might actually be able to reach out and help before it's too late. Whereas if you didn't have this information, they would just disappear and you'd be like, where'd they go?
Yeah.
You know, they'd stop answering your phone calls and that would be it.
If someone did start to notice a friend or a loved one like starting to go down that path, what mm-hmm. would kind of be the best course of action for that person to take?
Yeah. So first of all, I would, because I definitely have people reach out to me about this for sure, that they have a loved one who they're concerned about. I would recommend a few different things. So on the level of what should you do in terms of your interaction with this person, right? The thing that seems to help the most with getting somebody out of a group is not direct confrontation. You know, oftentimes when people think of getting somebody out of a cult, they think of like deprogramming, right? Where, you know, in the 60s and 70s or even in the 80s, you know, it's like your family arranges somebody to like go in and then like extract you against your will and then like hold you in a hotel room until you're like convinced that this group is a cult. To be honest, that is not the most effective thing to do. What seems to be more effective is to start to promote critical thinking in this person mm-hmm. about that group. Start to ask questions, right? Like, oh, you know, they're wanting you to donate all this money. What are they using it for? Where is it going? You know, are you able to pay your bills? You know, kind of start to things that the cult would probably not want them to think about, right? Encourage them to start thinking about those things, right? And of course, also letting them know that you are there and that you love them and that, you know, if they decide they don't want to be a part of this group, that you will be there to help support them. In addition to promoting critical thinking and just letting them know that you're there, my other two suggestions would be for loved ones would be, again, to look into the International Cultic Studies Association. They kind of have three branches. They've got a branch for professionals like myself, they've got a branch for former members, and then they've got a branch for loved ones, in terms of a support group or getting some resources, things like that. And then honestly, my third suggestion, and this clearly comes from my experience in the world of addiction, would be that if you really feel like you have lost a loved one to a group like this and your efforts have not been fruitful, would be to try a support group like Al-Anon. Al-Anon is a 12-step program that is for loved ones of alcoholics. But honestly, I refer people to Al-Anon a lot because the principles are pretty much the same if you're the loved one of an alcoholic, if you're the loved one of somebody with a mental illness, if you're the loved one of somebody who's in a cult. It's about the fact that you didn't cause this problem, you cannot control this person, you cannot save this person. How can you still have a relationship with them in a way that is healthy for you, mm-hmm. right? Because that can be a big challenge. So I would also recommend getting that kind of support as well.
That's amazing. Yeah, and I think that is really important too, is understanding like you didn't cause the problem. Dr. Feinblatt, this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Great.
that's today's show. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at @sitstill_lookopinionated and on Twitter at @sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and written by myself, Claire Malkey, and Michael Dritto. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malkey. See you next week. Bye.